Good afternoon, everybody. And a belated happy birthday, Hans. Because these two wonderful retrospectives, the first Hans has had in Germany, in Berlin and Hamburg, which were, if you're not aware of them, they're sort of a pair, really, not exactly duplicating each other.
They complemented each other.
And there were two new works, one for each site, were partly a celebration of Hans's 70th birthday in 2006. So happy birthday. This is also extraordinarily timely because we have had that 10-year watershed again where Documenta, Münster and the Venice Biennale all coalesce, plus the Basel Art Fair for those who go to art fairs. And that's an awful lot of art to look at this summer. And it occurred to me that actually Hans Hacker is actually Mr. Documenta, because not only has he been in so many, and I've listed some, 1959, the second one, sort of, we'll come back to that, number 5 in 1972, number 7 in 1982, number 8 in 1987, not in number 9, Jan Hurt, and number 10, 1997. So, and more than that, you were born in Kassel.
No.
No, near Kassel?
I studied in Kassel.
Studied in Kassel. You studied painting in Kassel, yes?
Art education.
Art education, okay. I'll get something right. And there was a wonderful little illumination, well, several actually, in Walter Grasskamp's essay in this handsome catalogue for the two exhibitions, which is really splendid, where he had one of those serendipities that an editor dreams of, which is he was going through the archive to write about Documenta, and he came across this little black and white photograph, and he thought it was the most apt juxtaposition of people in front of work being either installed or the audience and their reaction, or in some cases non-reaction, to the Kandinsky in particular that was on show. And there was a boy reading a comic with his back to the art. There were couples desperately trying to read the handouts. There were pictures of installations of the work, the kind of behind-the-scenes stuff that nobody ever sees, the public never sees. And he found this in the archive, and it wasn't signed. And he published it in his magazine with an introduction explaining this. And he gave a copy of this, freshly minted, to Hans Hacker, who said, oh, actually, I took those photographs. When I was a student, I acted as an assistant for Documenta, number 2 in 1959, the first in 55. And Grasskamp makes the point that in a way, although you were then studying art education and painting, this actually prefigured, in a way, your whole practice. Would you agree with that?
Well, there may be something to it, that in the sense that I, like all the other people in the audience there, saw these paintings for the first time, but I also had an opportunity to look behind the scenes and understand that this is an enormous operation, that all sorts of interests are in play, and that they need cleaning women as much as they need collectors, public funding in the case of Documenta, etc., etc. So this is not just beauty on the wall. There's more to it.
So you revealed the context and the whole system that ends up with this perfect aesthetic experience that people had no awareness of before. At what point did this start to play into how you thought of making work yourself? When would you date that?
That, I think, can be dated to the end of the 60s. When, like many of my generation became politicized, due to the Vietnam War, for one, but also other things that occurred internally in the U.S. in terms of racial relations, poverty, etc., etc. This is when my generation in the U.S. became politicized, and that is also when I became aware, well, became more aware of the fact that exhibiting in a commercial gallery, in a museum, or wherever it may be, is part of a larger social engagement, and that what happens there, well, I'm tempted to say infects what you put into these venues. Mm. There is no object, no painting, no photograph, no anything that is not affected by the context in which it appears, for one, the lighting of the room, the architectural conditions of the room, but also the status and the meaning of the institutional context in which this is introduced.
Of course, a lot of this has been latterly subsumed into something called institutional critique. But in fact, you've always gone rather beyond institutional critique, even before the term was coined, because in a way you showed a way both out of the museum and legitimate ways back into the museum, so that it was never simply standing outside and critiquing, because you were also part of it. Absolutely. And as part of that, you, as one essayist put it in your catalogue, so I don't want to appropriate what she said, she described you as having developed, if you like, your own audience in a democratic way, Rosalind Deutscher, that you developed the audience for art as a kind of democratic model, in a way, of how people could relate to the institution and to art. So it was never just about the art and the institution, but developing, if you like, a sort of model in your audience, because you first of all tried to find out who your audience was, famously in the profile of the audience coming to a show. You asked them to fill out a questionnaire. So for the first time, this of course is commonplace now and is now actually used as a marketing device. But when Hans Hacker initiated this audience profile, completely voluntary, it was the first time anyone had actually asked themselves, who does come to an exhibition, let alone why? And so that was, at the time, was there much resistance to that idea? When you proposed it as a... It was for the information show.
Well, the information show poll, which was a single question in 1970, was a politically very pointed question. And when I was invited to participate in the show, I rather abstractly told the curator it will be a question about a current issue, not spelling out what it would be. Mm-hmm. And I came in with the question the night before the opening to install it, fearing, and probably for good reason, that had the museum or the curator seen the question beforehand, something might have happened that this particular question would go up on the wall in that very institution.
Right, well, you were right to be nervous, because of course soon after that came the famous or infamous cancellation of your show at the Guggenheim. So I'm sure you may be a bit tired of talking about this, but it's such a key issue that, if you don't mind, I would like to remind people who may not know that, in fact, the work seemed to surprise the museum, the Guggenheim. I mean, it's an amazing thing to be offered a Guggenheim solo show in your 30s. And the work that Hans Hacker famously tried to show is, to give it its full title, Schapolsky et al., Manhattan Real Estate Holdings, A Real-Time Social System, as of May 1971. This is about In England, we would call it a rackman like landlord. This is a slum landlord whose connections and holdings of property in New York, Hans Hacker charted and listed and installed in a quasi-conceptual manner. Certainly, the formally it looked like a conceptual work, but could also be said to actually be almost a satirical take on conceptual art. But at any rate, it looked like conceptual art, but it actually was dealing with hard information. And there should have been some warning, if you like, that something like this might be in the offing because of the profile you'd done. The next thing was, okay, so who are the people who are excluded from museums? In fact, from much else besides, people who live in these areas of slum dwellings. And the piece, famously, was rejected and the show cancelled. And the Thomas Messer, the director, made the statement, to the degree to which an artist deliberately pursues aims that lie beyond art, his very concentration upon ulterior ends stands in conflict with the intrinsic nature of the work as an end in itself. Now, that already sounds like it's in aspic, but not in 1972.
Well, actually, if you take what he says there seriously, he would have to wipe out most of art history.
Yes, exactly. Because formalism was only a moment in art history, but obviously one he was still very caught up in. But of course, there were other issues which has been, in fact, a preoccupation of much of your work subsequently for personal reasons, but also because you realized the huge impact of this, not just in a personal sense, which is all the forces that go towards decisions made about who and what is shown when and where. But what I wanted to ask you about, particularly from today's perspective, is the solidarity that this generated in other artists who came out in support. Now, some of you may already know this, but the list of people who came out in support reads like a roll call of 20th and 21st century art. It is, if just randomly, the first few: Robert Barry, Mel Bochner, Daniel Buren, Dan Graham, Douglas Hubler, Neil Jenny, Sol LeWitt, Bryce Marden. Oh, I could go on and on and on. There's a long, long list. And these came out in solidarity with you. This also happened with another work that was rejected, when Marcel Broders and Daniel Buren again supported you. I wonder if this would happen today, when the market reigns so supreme, when artists are rather set against each other than in solidarity. Do you think it was a particular moment that enabled that solidarity to manifest itself?
Well, as I alluded to earlier already, my generation of artists came into maturity, so to speak, at a time when in the U.S., but also in Europe, in Paris, as we know, in Germany here as well, the young people in general, but also very much so the artists, were socially much more engaged, interested, and participated in what was happening around them. And perhaps this is another, although probably minor factor. There was no art market.
Mm.
It did not have the potential to ruin your career.
That's very, very... That's absolutely wonderful, because we bumped into Seth Siegler in Venice, who's doing a talk for Art Monthly in Bristol later this year in October. And we were talking about this very thing, and Seth Sieglaub said there was no possibility of artists selling out. No one wanted to buy. And it's very fair-minded of you to say that in a way, because it's all very well to say, well, artists today, you know, sell out, or in a way, as you say, the temptations weren't there. They're very much there today. And it's very interesting that when, as you also famously represented Venice, represented Germany with Nam June Paik in Venice, and you've seen some of you who came in earlier the slide of Germania and the installation in the German pavilion. And without describing it too much, since you've had a chance to see a bit of it, where there had been the Nazi emblem on the entrance, which was removed in 45, you placed the Deutschmark, and it was a symbol, ironically, of the triumph of capitalism, because the East German economy was tied now to the West German economy, and the Deutschmark rode very high at the time. And it struck me as extraordinarily prescient, because Priel Berman, who's in our audience, has written about Venice for us in the coming issue, and he drew attention to the fact that Davide Croft, who is the president of the Biennale, is actually talking now of, again, allowing works from the Biennale to be sold directly. Of course, most of us think it's an art market anyway, though I think there are certain rules and regulations about selling.
It was, in fact, founded as an art fair.
Yes, in 45 and then 68.
No, way back.
Oh,
in
way
the 19th
back.
Century.
Oh, right, the 19th century. Yeah, yeah. I didn't realize that. But they did sell work between 45 and 68. Interesting that this stopped at 68. Again, that political era. But they're talking again of bringing it back. So your work was rather prescient in many ways. What do you think about that? What do you think about art fairs? Have you ever allowed your work to be represented at an art fair?
No, I saw the Cologne Art Fair in the late 60s, maybe the second one that came about, and I saw it because my parents at the time lived close by, so I visited them, and I thought, well, okay, go and see the art fair. And I was so disgusted that I took the next plane back to New York. I could have stayed a little longer. And since then, I have told everybody who has works of mine in the gallery or otherwise that they should not have my work in art fairs, because there everything is really turned into a monetary value, and there's nothing else you can see.
It's interesting. I think some artists in this audience would like to know how on earth you made a living, because going through how many works have been rejected or vandalized, removed from shows. You don't allow your work to be shown in art fairs. You make work that is, as Raskamp pointed out, is not just site-specific, but politically site-specific, making it doubly hard to sell, if you like. There isn't much product, and there was plenty of product in Venice. Teaching was obviously a crucial part of your career as an artist. What has teaching meant to you? I'm sure I know what it meant to your students, since we bump into them all over. We were saying over lunch that John Baldessari, Hans Hacker, Joseph Beuys in a slightly different way, are possibly responsible. Oh, and Bernd and Hilla Becker. So many artists they've educated and been involved with their education in art all over Europe and America. So we hold you accountable. What has teaching meant to you, though?
Well, to begin with, it was my economic base. And it may have been as early as Documenta, when I looked behind the scenes, that I said, I do not want to be dependent on the sale of my work. And since I was studying art education to begin with, and teaching and dealing with younger people was something that was attractive to me. And it was, in a way, also convenient, particularly if you teach at the college level. You do not have to go to school every day. It leaves you some time, and at the college level, your vacations are much longer. So, on the one hand, that gave me the money to pay my rent, to subsistence, etc., etc., gave me my independence. But, and this is really the other part of the question that you posed, I did enjoy dealing with younger people, and I learned a lot from them. And it allowed me to be in touch with different generations and getting a bit of an inkling, at least, where their head is at, what they have to contend with, and they were very useful, challenging me not to engage in art speak. I had to speak plain. And that is a very good discipline to be subjected to.
Because I did notice that at the time you were selected to represent Germany in the Venice Pavilion, only two works of yours were owned by German museums. Only two works. And that's 1993. It's shocking, really.
It's only one more now.
Oh, so really in a hurry now. In your show in the Kunstakademie in Berlin, those of you who haven't been there, it's actually right next to the Brandenburg Gate, so of course an incredibly evocative space in the former eastern side of Berlin. And